location. And Roger had the idea that real example of what the individual programs or staff go through when they try to prioritize their sites. As an entree, I also want to say this is just an example of one program, but virtually all the programs which engage all the staff in our office have gone through this process of prioritization in one form or another in their individual programs. Not unique that the site cleanup program has done it and none of the others have. That's not the case. And this is also a primer for the newer board members. Somebody, I think it was Bruce, said that, playing catch up. This is an opportunity to see what we're doing at an individual program level with respect to prioritizing our sites. Mike, you said you were talking about the 50,000 foot priorities. And you visualize that as a tool. That's exactly how we visualize that too, is it's a tool when we have competing interests and not enough staff to get to all the work that we have, which is the case we live in. And as we drill down into the site cleanup program, that's the reality we were confronted with. We have way too many sites. What are the most important sites? That's what we wanted to get at. First, let's just do some basic numbers on the site cleanup program. There's 237. I checked it 2 days ago. There's 237 sites in GeoTracker, which is our database that has all of the groundwater information, soil information, reports, etc., publicly available information. Currently 237 sites. We have about 7 staff to work on those 237 sites. And as you've heard in abundance, over the last decade or 5 years, there's a decreasing trend in this number. Number of staff available. So in 2007, we asked a fairly basic question: are we working on the most important things, and how do we know that? And then a slightly subtler version of that question is: are we spending the majority of our time on those most important things that we identify? To get at this, we developed a list in the site cleanup program. We developed a list of priority by which we would score each individual site that we had. And the three priorities we use for this scoring are the threat to human health. And this sounds familiar, having just looked at the 50,000 foot version. We looked at the threat to human health and the environment of an individual site. The technical complexity, and what that embodies is just the hydrogeology, what's going on there, is it complex? And also the chemical and or multitude of chemicals that we're dealing with, are they complex? Are they complicating each other? In some cases, once one acts as a co-solvent for another, pushing it farther down the road. And then a third criteria we use is, and this is kind of how we bring in the world, not just water quality, is what's the level of public participation on an individual project? Some have virtually none, some of our cleanup sites. Some are very complicated from a public participation point of view. Roger brought Olin up as an example. When you affect 200 people's drink or 200 drinking water wells, that has a real large domino effect in terms of public participation. And makes that project uniquely challenging. So we wanted to factor that in as we prioritized our individual site cleanup program sites.
So, John, if a bunch of people come to meetings, then that would increase the priority of that site relative to others?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. We don't want to be victimized by just a squeaky wheel. What we want to do is put the appropriate score there, given how many people's lives are potentially involved by the potential for exposure to these compounds. You know, we're going to have to do some outreach, whether they come to our meetings or not. We need to go outreach to them.
Okay, you know, I misunderstood that word.
Roger mentioned sometimes with site cleanup program, for volatile compounds. They will off-gas from groundwater back up into the environment above the groundwater, workspace, home space, breathing areas. We call those vapor issues. Those jump, by the way, right to the top of the list when we encounter dust. Those require a level of outreach, too, public outreach, that a non-vapor site would not create. So it makes the project uniquely more complicated when we have issues like that, and we wanted to try to factor that in.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
So that could read level of public impact.
Yeah.
Or impact on the public.
Yeah.
So
it could be both ways. It could be us trying to do outreach, or it could be the public trying to reach us and get our attention too, you know, the affected public. And how much.
So a project that has more technical complexity gets a higher priority because it's to be predicted that it will require more staff time to resolve?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
To what we will get back in terms of proposals for remediation or characterization will be more complicated. Yeah. And let me come back to the Olin example. The plume is, at its height, is 9 miles long and 500 feet deep, going through a lot of hydrogeology and 3 aquifers in the system. Very expensive wells, very complicated. And we try to model what's the ideal way to recover that.
So it takes a lot of staff time if we're doing it right.
Right.
So it sounds like you put more staff time on the things that take more staff time and cost more money, which is counterintuitive in a way.
It's all three, though, because if we had a case that was no threat to public health, but it's complex and a lot of people are interested in it, it may not be a high priority.
Right, and we have those things. We just can't get to them. And as we work through those that rank higher, we will get to those sites. But at this point, they don't rank high enough in the prioritization scheme for us to warrant chasing them at this moment.
So I'm curious more about how you, as a section manager, supervisor, go about your prioritization. Is this done with all of your staff under you? And do they all have input into this process?
Yes.
Who ultimately is making the decision? Is it you, or does it go up the chain?
Well, it starts with the individual staff. They know the individual site details the best of anybody in the chain. So they, in this example and in other prioritization examples in the groundwater protection section, that's the section I oversee, that's how we've done it, is we start with staff. And then we take a look at how they've scored. And there, at times, I'll be honest with you, there may be some correction that goes on. Sometimes we tend to overvalue, some of us, the importance of the work that we're doing.
I'll make sure you're answering the
okay.
right question.
Same question.
Are you asking about how to develop the criteria or how the staff
scored the
established criteria?
Yeah, how the prioritization comes out in the end.
How it's applied.
The scoring. How the
okay.
scoring is done and how one site is deemed to be more important than another using these criteria.
So we take these three criteria, and if you have any questions about how we settled on these three criteria, I'd be happy to try to answer that. But with these three criteria, we weighted the first two the same. The third criteria is a little less weighted. It's I think it was weighted at 60%. I'm looking at Sheila, because Sheila is involved in this as well. And then we have the individual staff score, affix a score to each of these criteria. And then I'll cut to it. Then we sum up or agglomerate all of it and look for what's it telling us, in a sense.
And this is an individual staff person is doing this to each one of their sites.
Right. Each of those
staff person might have 50 sites, and they're applying the criteria and ranking the criteria.
These are all 237?
Actually, this is only about 200, because This is actually the third iteration of the prioritization that we've done. This is the the 2010 version that you're looking at. There's 37 sites, essentially, that we have already taken off the table because they were the lowest priority.
Okay.
So we're not reprioritizing the lowest that we weren't working on already. We're just reprioritizing the ones that we've committed to work on.
So, yeah, this is all of them that we're working on.
Right. So ballpark 200 right there. So each of these green dots represents one site that has been scored. Now, this graph is a little counterintuitive, and I'm going to walk you through it just for a second. So, on the vertical axis is the score. On the horizontal axis is the number of sites. The lowest sites or diamonds on this are the highest priority sites. It's a little counterintuitive, but essentially, when the scoring was done, the lowest number meant it was the highest priority. Mm-hmm. And so, as you sum all of those, the lowest value are the ones down towards the bottom. Those are the highest priority sites. A little bit counterintuitive when you look at it in graphical form. So we looked for the natural breaks here, and what we found were about 5.5, score of about 5.5, and score of 8 were about where we tried to create the high to medium and medium and medium to low breaks. Get all my points that
I. John, can you simply answer, if you can't simply answer, it's probably not worth the time, why you couldn't have lowered the low bar to be just between 7 and 8 to get rid of that one line, to put that dense line in the low?
The cluster at about 5.8?
Yeah.
Try to capture that.
Bruce,
right, I can't read the side numbers too well, but yeah, that dense line, if it
was 8.
Okay, so if the top bar, which was the bottom of the low, was dropped down a notch, just why didn't it work out that way?
Okay.
You'd lose a lot of them.
Right. Mike says you'd lose a lot of them. And the next slide, I think, kind of starts to answer that. So it's not enough to do prioritization if it doesn't change how you do your work. All you've learned is, wow, I got a totem pole of sites. It hasn't changed how you do your work, though. And that's the follow-through on this. Once you're informed by your priorities, how are you going to do your work differently? I come back to that subtle question I asked at the start. Are we spending the majority of our time on the most important things? And so we established what we call some business rules around the chart of prioritization, and that is that we spend 90% of the time on the high and medium priority sites, and only 10%, limiting ourselves to only 10% on the lowest portion. Had we moved that line down and bumped that, go backwards actually. So we bring that upper red line down and don't capture that long band of green sites, green diamonds. They suddenly will get a lot less attention, dramatically less attention as sites. And that's a possibility. That's a choice we could make. And at this point, we think we're comfortable keeping them in the focus of 90% of our time. If we feel like we're not making adequate progress on those things that we would term high priority, we might consider changing where we make the break, such that we can focus more time on the human health, the high human health risk sites.
So if you only had 5 people, you drop it down to 6.
Right, right.
If you needed to, or even
exactly,
lower.
Exactly, we're gonna push the group around.
Right. So if these are the highest priority sites, right?
Zolan and sites you're well familiar with.
So John, correct me if I'm wrong, but this site is higher priority than this one.
Correct.
Right. So these are your highest priority sites right here. So as we lose people, lose resources, if we get to a point where we can only work on these, those are the only ones we're going to work on. Mm-hmm. Regardless of where that line is, regardless of where that line is, we're only going to work on these. Each one of these are vertically prioritized. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So remind me if you told me this before or if I just don't know. When you're going through this process, you're spending staff time, and somebody's got to address the economics of the consequence on their end. Is there also permit fees that are coming back to a water board function, or is there, and if there is, what's the percentage of expense recoupment there?
Well, most of this is on cost recovery, so it's directly billed back to the discharging party or the responsible
your
party.
Staff time, too.
Correct.
And is it a not real high percentage of recovery?
Yes.
Very high.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because they're required by law to provide that recovery, okay. So there's enforcement if they don't.
In some cases, I'll use Olin again as an example, they also have permits. Olin is reinjecting the water. They had to apply for waste discharge requirements that came in front of the board in, I believe, a year ago, July. So a year ago, we were in Watsonville, and the board approved it, waste discharge requirements for the reinjection. So they're likely also paying, to answer your question in full, they're likely also paying fees for the waste discharge requirement.
Thank you, Sam.
But that's kind of unique.
Yeah, that's rare.
Pretty unique to the site cleanup program as far as being cost recovery. So if we were just talking about NPDES permits, waste discharge requirements, be a completely different answer.
Understood.
Could be fees.
Right.
Right. Okay, so we talked about business rules. Any questions on that? Okay. Last thing I say, prioritization is unending. This is a dynamic thing that we're working with. This isn't, hey, we got our priorities, good, we're done, check that off the list, let's move on. We have to periodically recycle through, and we found that we do this about every 2 years. We're doing it in 2012, we're actually doing it this summer in 2012. You have to reprioritize for a variety of reasons. One is we're going to be successful at cleaning up these sites, and their risk is going to go down, and they will move up that graph we just looked at with time. We're actually seeing in this cycle of reprioritization that two sites that were high priority are moving up into the medium priority category, which is, we'll talk about this hopefully a little bit more, but that's a measure of success too. It's becoming diminished in priority. Also, we close approximately 6 to 10 sites a year, meaning we're done with those sites. They meet cleanup goals. And so they come off the chart entirely. They stopped it being active sites for us. And unfortunately, from time to time, about 3 to 5 new sites join us each year. And so we have to factor in how are they relative to our existing priorities. So we have to run the priority thing again for that.
To confirm what you said, when you do your prioritization, it's basically a blend of quantitative and qualitative analysis.
Yeah. Yeah.
How much, and what's the cost? How much, let's say, acreage?
Right.
And what's the density?
What's the relative complexity of the site? That's sort of a qualitative analysis. But then we can go quantitative and say, what's the concentration of groundwater at this domestic well relative to the health number, the maximum contaminants?
Are you doing that intuitively, or is this actually part of the matrix that staff has to go through?
We have a little bit of standardized rule for how to score a site. We have a small amount of that. It's about two-thirds of a page on how to how to address the criteria in terms of scoring. Part of what we're trying to do is we're creating a little bit of a culture around this, is that we want to be aware of our priorities. As people retire and new employees come in, we want to have sort of this legacy, this here's how we score, you know, so that it's not lost information as time goes on, to build it into our culture.
John, given that 6 to 10 are closing out and approximately 5 are coming in, are you seeing a slight decrease in the overall number?
Yes, yes, and a definition of success both for the site cleanup program, but really for the underground tanks program, another groundwater protection program, is our goal is to go out of business in a sense. And we're much more aggressive in terms of closure. We're closing sites faster in the underground tanks program. And so our rate of decline in caseload is greater in the underground tanks program. And with respect to the underground tanks program, we see about 10 years left, we think, until we can get to the zero point, or very close to the zero point, which goes well in a declining resource environment. You know, as we decrease the available staff, it would be nice to also decrease the necessary workload, and the tanks program on some level complies with that.
So the tanks program, isn't it still going to, I mean, I understand that there's no single wall tanks going in anymore and all that stuff, but isn't there still going to be some entry of new sites into that program?
Yeah.
I mean, how
yeah,
does it disappear?
Piping a leak and things like that, there will be new sites generated through time, but the rate of new sites relative to the rate of closure, the rate of closure is much greater.
Is that just because of better engineering in
yes.
tanks?
Right. This is the prevention side
right.
of it. The way we used to design and operate underground tanks was terrible. It resulted in all of them. So the laws were changed, the regulations were changed. Now we have double-walled tanks and containment systems and
detection
early
systems.
Warnings.
The gas stations went out of business.
So it's all about prevention. And that greatly reduces the number of leaks.
But it's not going to go away.
It's going to become a very small program. Ideally, it will become a small, much smaller program okay. than it is right now. And I think that's what we have to envision. That should be a goal for us.
One thing.
Contraction of the program. Okay. And that's it. Happy to answer any more questions. I appreciate that you made that more of a dialogue format too than a lecture format. I think that's kind of some of the point of the offsite meeting is.
Is part of the consideration you make, and in not so much in the dry clean one, but the underground tank, have to do with the land use or restricting the land use or what's happening with the land use?
With respect to closing it?
In your prioritization. So anyway, we just had one 2 weeks ago at Planning Commission, which was, and sure's on your list, it's Foothill and Highway 154. It was a two-gas station site and mobile-owned land and sold it to the Tobes Group, and the Tobes Group is a developer in town who has a history of doing mixed-use projects with low or mid-income housing. Well, Mobile put a deed restriction on it that it would be no residential, but it's allowed commercial. So Sansom's going to put a four-unit outpatient operating room plus five other disciplines there, and they'll have 300 people there every day. But there was a restriction on it from the deed use because of the ongoing groundwater contamination from the underground sand that Mobile wouldn't let the purchaser have a residential there. So I'm just wondering, in your prioritization, when you're looking at it, if there's a development or a potential development or a restriction of development, does that play a role in how you prioritize, or
typically not,
okay.
Because that's factored in towards the end of the life of the project. Although one question Steve may remember, I started in Region 2, San Francisco Bay Region, very urban region, and so the first, and I worked in the site cleanup program as a staff person. And one of the first questions typically out of my mouth is, what's your redevelopment scenario? Because the real estate is so expensive in Region 2 that you can't leave the land fallow. You can't walk away. You have to redevelop. What your redevelopment scenario was would drive what our cleanup alternatives
okay.
were. If you were okay not making it residential, then we can consider the possibility of higher concentrations left in place under a deed restriction.
And the regional board is the one that requires a deed restriction.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
In the case of, I want to make a distinction here, subtle distinction for you, because you're from the case you spoke about was a tank in Santa Barbara County. Santa Barbara County is a local oversight program contracted directly to state board. We don't oversee the tanks program.
It's actually a city. It's actually a city lot.
City.
It's a weird spot. It's a carve out spot out there.
I think
in
the
county
still
but
oversees
it's a city,
those.
It's a city's own lot.
I think the county still oversees the tank cleanup
maybe
in that area.
Yeah.
We're not engaged there because the county environmental staff is contracted directly with state board in that case. It's sort of like a donut hole in the region in terms
all
of
those
our
people
tank
who are bad mouthing Mobile should be bad mouthing water board, right?
No, it should be bad mouthing
yeah.
county health.
Yeah.
Let's get our bad mouthing here.
But not to do it. Case, but I'm missing something. thing where, on one hand, there is restriction from having housing, but on the other hand, you have up to 300 occupants within that same footprint, and if I understood correctly, we're talking about a healthcare facility, so we have people who have already a weak immune system.
Potentially compromised immune system, yeah.
So I'm missing something that, on one hand, we say you can have perhaps, what would it be, maybe six homes? So you know, you got.
It would have been a lot.
A lot more?
Yeah. So but it was really phrased as that it was mobile and put on the deed restrictions. I'm really curious now to go back and find out if it was really mobile who put it on the deed restriction to cover their potential liability in the future, or if it was a water board. And then if it was a water board process, then that question is really interesting too. And how does the water board determine what redevelopment is going to be, and is there different levels for residential versus commercial use?
And it could be a joint thing if mobile said, okay, we want to put in the deed restriction, and the local oversight program says, okay, then you don't have to clean up to such a high extent.
Okay. Then you're dead forever, basically, for residential redevelopment, right?
Right. There are,
or if you go back and clean up, do a second cleanup, then you can come back and lift the deed restriction.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can lift it, but you'd have to remediate more.
So somebody might not be fessing up there on. They just didn't want to go pay extra money to do better cleanup.
Right. That could have been a mobile decision, too. Yeah. To answer Jean-Pierre's question, the way human health risk is done is based on the time of, it's on the dosage and time of exposure. So with respect to residential versus a workplace, your exposure time is greater in residential. They would calculate out the number of hours you would be exposed. And really, it's driven by children. Children will and pregnant women will be the drivers for health risk. And what their time of exposure is and what the concentration of the soil or groundwater that remains is. And the commercial reuse has a significantly lower exposure time because you're there theorized 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, versus a residential scenario where you're there the entire week potentially, all hours, 52 weeks a year. Actually, they calculated, I think, to 50 weeks a year, making the assumption that you'll leave for 2 weeks a year. That's how health risk is done. So that's why it's deemed riskier for residential if at a given concentration than it is for a commercial. The county, in this case, the county health always has the right, in a case where there's a deed restriction, to require a human health risk for specific reuse scenarios, like a compromised immune system, for example. If they think that this reuse scenario doesn't fit what's still in the soil or groundwater at that site. So that's an option for county health and county, you know, the permitting. Or in this case, it sounds like city would be doing the permitting for like a building permit.
Thank you. Any other questions for John? Okay. Maybe the best bet in the interest of time would be to, I wanted to pick up on a few of the things the board members brought up initially that we didn't touch on already, and then maybe talk a little bit about part D here, advocacy versus recommendations.
Fine.
Okay. So I just made a few little stars here by some of the things I wanted to address that you brought up. Russ, you mentioned the problem of misinformation out there, and that it'd be a good idea if we could help with that problem. And so with something that is very recent, with the ag order, we have definitely tried to do that. We've had a series of workshops with growers. I don't know if any of us knows the number of workshops, six or something like that.
Quite a few.
Yeah, throughout the region. And that's one of the things that we've been dealing with, is that misinformation that's obvious by
questions that we're getting from some of the growers. Some of the growers apparently are pretty well informed, but there is certainly the potential for misinformation. We just saw a letter. I just saw a letter this morning that was filled with obvious misinformation. That seems like maybe a grower was just given bad information. I don't think it was something he read in our materials, he or she. But anyway, so that's an example of where we have tried to talk directly with growers. They've been pretty well attended from what I've heard. Those workshops, and that work is going to be ongoing. And I don't think you're talking just about ag, but
no.
that may be right at the top of the list right now in terms of that.
Well, it's the most
difficulty
in our minds, I'm sure.
Right. Let's see. So yeah, we've been trying to do that. Jeff, you and I talked about different ways of trying to deal with that as well. And it's a tough problem because this information can come from anywhere. So we have to keep trying, and we are definitely putting a lot of time and energy into it.
Well, I think it goes back to Mike's point. It's better to be preventative than reactive. And if we can get to it early on, I think it would solve a lot of the issues and the long duration of hearings and so forth if we can get that information out there ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the misinformation is out there, it's hard to bring that back in and correct it.
Right.
So my thoughts are if we can use preventative ways of doing that by getting out there right at the beginning and explaining to the different groups what the issues really are and what we think the resolutions would be to those issues.
Roger, in regards to that, I have a question that's kind of been in my mind a lot lately. This year we had two large and highly contentious issues, the Salinas stormwater permit and the ag order waiver. They both seem to have constituencies telling us if you do this, it's going to be extreme hardship. And they both had information that some might characterize as misinformation. Recall that the stormwater permit said they were going to cost the city of Salinas $85 million. And my question is why they ended up differently. The stormwater permit ended up with basically with the city of Salinas saying, now we get it. We don't necessarily like every bit of it, but it's doable. Thank you for working with us. We're going to do this together as a partnership. It was a very good ending to that issue. The ag order didn't end that way. But they were, and they both had like a 5-year turnover that took more than 5 years because of extended workshops and lack of quorum. So they're on parallel tracks. Why do you think they ended up, one, more of a partnership and another, more of an adversarial ending?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that I have the answer to that, but just observation is that there were some real similarities in that my understanding is that in both cases they basically had outside folks come in and provide these cost estimates. So I believe the city of Salinas had a consultant come in and add up everything that they thought was going to cost them city money from the draft permit, and made a lot of assumptions, not being terribly familiar with the permit, apparently the draft permit, and came up with this big number. With the ag order, they had outside economists come in, and we disagreed with their methods for how they came up with those numbers as well. In both cases, we pointed that out. So with the city of Salinas, staff sat down with the city, said, okay, where are you getting this number? And went point by point, and just with one assumption, it knocked out, I think, 90% of the number, the value. You know, 75 out of the 85 million, or something like that, just with one bad assumption. And with the ag order, we attempted to do something similar to find out, okay, where did you get these numbers? It was from a survey. Well, could we take a look at the survey and see what questions you ask in order to come up with these numbers. And no, can't see the survey questions. So we tried, again, this is kind of my vision of it, we tried to sit down and say, okay, where are these misconceptions coming from, or at least from our standpoint, they're misconceptions. Certainly, it's possible that they would have shown us something, in either case, the city of Salinas or with ag folks, where there's something we didn't realize that was going to be as expensive as they said, and that we were underestimating, right? So either way, we were looking to try to straighten that out. So we attempted to do pretty similar things from my way of looking at it, from my viewpoint. I think with the city of Salinas, we're dealing with one entity.
Thank you.
You know, even though there are a lot of people in the city of Salinas, but we're basically dealing with a point person and his staff, and it's a whole lot easier to sit down and work something out than with 3,000 growers, even though the numbers were really coming from a handful of people as well. But nevertheless, it's a bigger group that we're dealing with.
All right.
That's just my take on it. It's just my.
I would say the other big difference is with Salinas, what we were asking them, the format had changed dramatically from their last permit, but what we were asking them to do was really not an order of magnitude greater than they'd already been doing. The big problem with Salinas was they just had real trouble comprehending all of it, getting their head around it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we were asking them to do was greater in some areas, but it wasn't hugely different. What we were asking ag to do was substantially different than I mean, in some areas there was not big change, but in other areas there was huge change.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I think that was a factor as well.
So tier three large changes drove a lot of the concern.
Yeah, I think a lot of the tier three players. I mean, I think that I can never remember which is the top tier and which is the bottom.
Tier three is the more severe threat.
Okay, so a lot of the tier one folks, it was like with Salinas, a question initially of just not really getting what was going on. I think that most of the tier three folks were, a lot of them were bigger operations that really understood what we were talking about. That it was a more substantive question of they didn't think it was the right approach. It was not the approach they wanted to take. Yada yada yada. So I think they were substantially different problems. They look alike in some ways, and they were on the same track, but they were substantially different circumstances.
Kirk, did you want to add something?
Well, I think you're all heading in the right direction. I think the biggest single problem with agriculture is you don't have an entity to deal with. Not only do you don't have an entity to deal with, you have an industry that is not only diverse, but the individuals in it pride their individuality. But you've dealt with too many regions in the same process. The people in the Salinas Valley, the farmers in the Salinas Valley work with each other on a regular basis. Farmers in Santa Maria work with themselves on a regular basis. The farmers in Santa Maria are quite happy to have problems in Salinas work through there before they get to Santa Maria, and have a tendency to just wait, and because this is the way labor issues have happened and other environmental issues have happened in the past. But as a result, when you talk to somebody who was speaking on behalf of agriculture, they were bringing to you the lowest common denominator, a consensus of a 100%. So the farmer who says, I will do nothing, was able to establish the negotiating position. So you may have had large farms that were quite willing to do something that they felt was possible for their circumstances. But the message communicated by agriculture was the farmer, who might be very small, who says, I'm going to do nothing, because the internal method of discussing this among agriculture was to not disenfranchise anyone. And the only way to effectively do that is to give that one voice the majority. And you couldn't sit down with anybody and say, well, If we, you know, if you, like with the city of Salinas, well, if we move here, how much does that make a difference to you? So the staff sat down and said, well, if we do this, it made no difference because no one could respond. There was no one authorized to respond. And as a result, the strategy and tactics of each side defeated each other, because the staff's strategy was the same that it would use with the city of Salinas, and which is the same that they used with waste treatment plants and everything else. It couldn't work here. The agriculture strategy of combining 400,000 acres and 3,000 farmers didn't work for different reasons, but combined, it didn't work at all. I think to some extent the approach in the Central Valley might be better from the point of view of dealing with the regions individually instead of trying to deal with the, not the regions, the sub-regions individually, instead of trying to deal with the entire region all at once, because at least in Santa Maria, the growers get together and have a commonality of interest in Santa Maria and things that they're interested in. The growers in Salinas do. The growers in Pado are going to even have the same interest as growers in Salinas.
Right.
And if that was the case, I think the results would be different. Unfortunately, from a management point of view, from your management point of view, you would then have four or five aggregators. But I think each one would actually be easier in the long run, because there would be more buy-in by the growers in each of those areas than there is now, where there's a high level.
In fact, I think Region 5 is just now issuing its first set of watershed permits for groups that you're speaking of. That's how they've decided to do ag, is to break Region 5 down into component sub-regions.
To further supplement, I think your comment, which is spot on, is that with agriculture also you deal with different ag commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And each ag commodity tends to be very provincial in how they do business. For example, strawberry growers look at things one way, leafy greens look at things a different way. So you have the issue of the regions, as you point out. Within regions, you have different ag commodity groups. Then you have the uniqueness of agriculturists to tend to be very independent pictures. And even within the same ag commodity, if you go to a meeting, you're not going to have always a harmony. So it made the issue, I guess, on the sociological standpoint, very, very, a lot more difficult to deal with. Adding to that, the representation of the ag commodity groups were with different groups of farm growers. So you had the ag commodity groups, and you had representations of farm growers. And if you looked at the response of the different farm growers, you didn't even have consensus amongst the different farm bureaus within the region. That's not uncommon, by the way.
Yep.
You can have Santa Barbara County farm bureau taking one stand, and on the state level, farm bureau take a different stand. So that's not unique. Right? So that's the one thing I think that was difficult and perhaps a causation of a challenge is that it was not dealing with a homogeneous group. So when you say, well, let's talk to agriculturists, that was kind of a big term.
No, I think that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. Listen, the thing about Salinas, ever since I've been on the board, we've had the Salinas permit come up, I think, three times at least. What just happened this time is no different than what's happened in the past. This was not really a big item in the context of all the years. But it's a consistent reaction we get from Salinas of them maybe not being prepared, maybe not understanding. And there's always some friction that goes on when we get to the board meeting, with misunderstanding or them having bad information. Now, perhaps you could look at this in terms of how could we make that work better?
That's what I was thinking as far as priorities.
I know.
It's going to come back.
Could staff be going, preempting this ahead of time and going out and trying to, meet up with staff of Salinas or any other entity where this goes on frequently to try to iron things out and clear up the misunderstandings. That's a possibility. The flip side of that is Salinas knows the permit's there and it's being revised, modified, updated. They could be approaching our staff more frequently instead of at the 11th hour to try to get things worked out. You'll see through time many of our entities never come up on our agenda, that these permits just kind of go right through. They just kind of dealt with administratively. Others, they just seem to pop their heads up because there's some tension going on. And it's for various, you know, reasons like that. So they're almost like apples and oranges, you know, looking at why did this one seem to work out pretty well, and this other one, which is the 800-pound gorilla, which is as complex as anything, you know, could be.
The other thing with the 800-pound gorilla, if you talk about the ag order, is that the city of Salinas, that's one big entity. With the ag order, you have the agriculturists, you have environmental groups,
yeah,
and you have also the social justice, social equity. So I think, well, another layer of complexity, which I didn't quite see with the city of Salinas. It was not so much their issues of, you know, environmental concerns versus we're not doing enough versus we're doing too much, and also, you know, the social justice or social equity element. To say people, so I think beyond all the things we talked about, you know, of the agricultural groups not being the homogeneous group, we have two other layers of complexity.
With Salinas, we had a meeting where Russ had to point out to their staff that they had this sphere of influence that they weren't taking into consideration. And so there was some tension around that, where Russ essentially had to pull the truth out of them that they should have been including an area that they hadn't acknowledged in their planning process.
Well, not to, you know, sit here and defend the city of Salinas as a former mayor, but...
go ahead
anyway, Russ.
You know, I sympathize with, you know, communities, whether it's right. Salinas or Marina or San Luis Obispo, everybody has seen the diminishing resources that they have. Salinas has been hit extremely hard in the last 10 years, 15 years, with resources, and consequently the staff has changed. That's been one of their issues. And the information with the staff being changed constantly, the line of communication to the people who finally make the decision are not getting the proper information because that information is changing all the time. And I had a long conversation with Mayor Donahue, and he just frankly told me, he says, if it costs more and more penny, and I think you heard this before, I'm not supporting it. But, you know, and I told him, you're not looking at the whole picture. There's more to it than those dollars. It can bring more economic dollars to the community by doing this particular issue and looking at it in a different aspect. And I think maybe some of that finally got to the staff is that we saw the change in the staff, and even some of the questions I asked the person that was doing the staff's presentation, he was totally unaware because he was new to the whole project. And the acting city manager had to tell him, because I could have really pounded him into the ground, but that's not my point. The point is, I realize that communities well, you look at California, how many is now on filing Chapter 9 just because they don't have the resources?
Three.
Well, there's more to come.
San Bernardino.
Yeah.
So far.
So far.
Yeah,
but
so far.
There's more in line.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see Salinas come to that situation. But I think we have to take those things into consideration when we're making our decision. And that's why I was saying that we need to have better communications to the staff. Because once the information gets out there and it's tainted, it's so hard. That's why I'm getting back to, I think Mike was talking about being proactive. I think being proactive instead of reactive is a lot cheaper, not only for us, but also for them. And if we can get the true information to the right decision makers ahead of time, then in that particular situation, I think that's what happened at that one particular meeting. The light was finally turned on, and they understood some of what the staff was doing, and I think the interaction from that point on resolved the issue. Now, as Kirk has brought out in John Pierre, ag industry is huge, and it's so diverse within our region alone, not counting the rest of the state, that it's hard to just, you can't put ag in one box. There's many boxes in agriculture. And so that's where we have to work harder. Our staff, our board, us board members have to work harder. And I tell you, it's very hard for us as board members, and I see folks out here, that once we get an order coming before us, that we can't talk about it to the general public anymore. And I think if we could, we could resolve a lot of these things a lot faster. And I think there's more frustration from those folks that they can't talk to us. And I know Mayor Delgado, and I told him one of the first meetings, but one of the hardest things he's going to find as being a mayor, and I found, is when I came on this board, I'm used to talking to my constituents. If they call me and say, come and look at this project, I go look at it. I did. But as being on this board, you can't do that. And that kind of hamstrings us. And I think then we have to go through the staff to do that, where we don't have the knowledge ourselves or give the knowledge to those individual constituents.
This guy has his hand up, and then Mike.
I was wondering whether you had formulated your water quality plan for agriculture and then took it to them, or did you have ag involved in the development of the plan?
That's a long story.
Well, and the reason I'm asking, excuse me for interrupting, but I was I worked for the conservation district in San Joaquin Valley when SB 700 was passed, which brought agriculture into the air quality arena. Now, left to their own devices, the San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District came up with a 37-page air quality plan for every farm in San Joaquin Valley that was over 100 acres. Well, obviously that didn't set too well with agriculture. So the grower groups in the San Joaquin Valley that included the Nisei Farmers League and Manuel Cunha, I don't know if anyone recognizes that name, Cotton Growers and Generous Association, the Grape and Tree Fruit League, the Almond Growers, the Farm Bureau. We had a whole host of people sitting around the table with the water quality, the air quality district, as well as NRCS. Now, NRCS is Natural Resources Conservation Service, for those folks who don't know that acronym. We were the stabilizing...
Let me just cut you short, if I could. The answer is yes, there actually was an effort to bring everybody together to talk about the plan. What we're talking about now is the second permit. So, a first permit existed about 8-9 years ago, and a technical advisory committee had been formed related with members of the ag community, environmental groups, and staff. And they had been meeting to try and work out and discuss what you're talking about. So that was an approach that was used. It didn't work too well.
So. Well, the thing that I haven't heard that in your procedure that worked very well in the air quality arena was the addition of NRCS, because Natural Resources Conservation Service has an excellent reputation with agricultural producers as being fair, they're technical, they write conservation plans with agriculture, and agriculture, trust, and RCS.
I think they have been involved in the process.
But now
involved in our process.
Rather than coming up with a 37-page plan, we came up with a 2-page plan that agriculture supported. And then the agricultural groups took that out, not the air district, but the agricultural groups took that out to their constituents. We had dozens of meetings in all counties of the valley. So it's you're right. Agricultural folks are significantly different than industry folks or other bureaucracies, if you will. And I'm a bureaucrat myself, but working with agriculture is very ticklish, and they don't like to be told what to do. You have to work with them, and
we know that. Believe me, we're well aware of that.
We've been around that road.
Mike.
Yeah, I guess I was just briefly. I'm just curious as to, you know, in this discussion about the one-order approach we took, the multi-order approach that Region 5 is taking, I'm just curious to see if, either on a commodity or a watershed level, we see groups of agriculturalists taking advantage of the provisions for alternate collective compliance or monitoring schemes and proposing them to us. Have we seen any of that yet? Or is everybody waiting to see how the petitions come out?
Well, we did get a request for extending the deadline for indicating whether they want to exercise it for, say, the groundwater monitoring. So I guess that shows some interest in pursuing that, recognizing that. And we agreed with that extension and made it something we could do administratively.
That was an extension to July 1st?
Yeah, I think it went to August 31st.
But beyond that, it would be helpful if the technical advisory committee was worked on, because there are other the groundwater, the quadrant groundwater plan is a unique thing, and the extension to indicate the grower's willingness to participate is extended to August 1st. But there's still a possibility for other for farmers in other regions to have cooperative programs to meet other goals.
That's correct.
And in order to do that, there needs to be a technical committee established so that there can be some type of feedback, because it's difficult, if not impossible, for a group of farmers to come up with a good idea on their own without talking to someone to make sure that it's a good idea,
either from the technical advisory committee
or from staff, before they walk in and present it to the executive officer. Because the ag order as written, which is correct, says the executive officer approves it, but it's helpful to have something, you know, some feedback from somebody who's sincere about putting together a cooperative proposal before it goes to the executive officer for final review.
So apart from the groundwater monitoring, in terms of, because there's also provisions for compliance.
Projects.
Yeah. Have we got time deadlines to indicate interest in those?
It could be done at any time.
And what's our progress on the technical advisory committee? Because that was actually my next question. It does seem like that's a kind of a necessary step to.
Yeah, definitely will be once we have some proposals. I haven't heard of any proposals coming forth.
Except what we're talking here. I mean, what I was just hearing makes sense, that if there's a technical advisory committee, that people can bounce proposals off rather than having to come up with something fully fleshed and then being told, no, this is the wrong ballpark.
Right. But I don't know about you, but I haven't heard of anybody even thinking about doing a proposal at this point.
Does that stop us from putting together a technical advisory committee?
I would say people are thinking about it, but I mean, there is the language in the order that kind of outlines some of this process, which is really helpful. But until that process is in place, people are not really willing to invest the time unless they know who they're going before to present these proposals. And so they can have some preliminary discussions bouncing around the ideas before you're really investing in the order. Mm-hmm.
To
that point, though, I have been contacted by the staff and the regional board. And so I know that, I don't know, maybe you can speak more to this, but the wheels are turning in terms of putting that together, but it would be good to have kind of a timeline or update on when that will happen.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So, for example, Ross Clark came to a board meeting.
I've just been advised that perhaps we are straying a little far afield from our agenda item and getting into an item that is before the State Water Board. And so I think we need to shift back to
something
a little more
that?
Benign. Go ahead.
I understand there's a petition of the Ag Order before the State Water Board. However, my understanding is that unless and until a stay is issued, the order that it remains in effect. And it seems like what we're doing here is we're simply asking staff what their progress is on implementation of the order. How is that a problem?
There are actually 5 petitions pending, and the order is still in full effect unless the State Board stays it. This is noticed as a discussion of priorities. It refers to status. If you want a brief status update or a discussion of how this fits in with priorities, I think that's fine. But if there's going to be a detailed discussion of plans for the Ag Order, how it should be moving forward, it really should be noticed.
I agree. What I'd like to hear is a brief status report on where we are on putting together the technical advisory committee. And yes, I have thoughts on priorities on that ought to be a high priority. But I don't think that we need to go, I'm not intending to go into more level of detail than that. So does that work?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, our focus has been on the workshops to go out and talk to the growers about implementation of the order in terms of all the aspects, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. We've also been invited to attend a workshop or two that were not our workshops, but there's one for the vintners, specifically for Tier, I think, geared towards Tier 1. And so that's really been our focus since the Ag Order has been adopted. As I said, we put a lot of time and effort into that. And, you know, it's possible that we've heard some of the things that you were talking about, that our staff has heard that. I haven't myself. But it sounds like maybe that's something that we need to work on next, would be putting together the TAC. But, you know, if we receive phone calls about, gee, that's slowing us down, we don't have a TAC, I'm not aware of those. So
it simply seems logical.
It makes sense to proceed with that, and maybe Angela has that on her list. But like I say, up until now, it's been the workshops have been the focus.
Do we have no TAC at all that's been functioning over the past 2 years to... Two and a half years.
There's no formal TAC. Yeah. There are lots of people involved.
Right,
in,
but
in
we had
project.
A TAC at one point.
Are you thinking of the advisory group?
Yeah,
that's not a TAC. That was not a technical advisory committee. Okay. That wouldn't be the group.
Yeah, the order has very specific, very specific listings of positions on the TAC.
Right, we don't have that.
Okay. So that seems to be.
We have not had that.
I can add a little bit to what Roger is saying. Staff are considering who would be the right people for that TAC based on what's in the order, the requirements, their experience, their background. So they are considering that, and they're talking to people about that, about serving on that TAC. And staff are also reaching out to people about projects, the sanctuary folks, Ross Clark, who came to our board meeting, and talking about the construction of wetlands, where it would be done, the scale, how they would be designed, who would design them, and where the money would come from to do it. And one of the sources of money that we have, that the board has, is a $3 million grant for irrigation efficiency, and we're modifying that grant. We were in the process of modifying it a few weeks ago to allow funding for these types of projects. So we are working on moving that forward. And we can give the board a more detailed update in an email.
I just want to be clear. I mean, a key part of the basis on which I voted for the order was the ability of of agricultural is to propose alternate means of compliance. And I can't speak for anybody else. And so it seems to me that putting the pieces in place that will make, it seems to me that we it should be a priority of ours to be encouraging such proposals. The order gives us all the power in the world to shoot them down if they don't meet our criteria. Either at the executive officer level, TAC level, executive officer level, the board level. But it seems like we should be encouraging, in terms of encouraging a collaboration and trying to rebuild some of that we should be encouraging the formation of those.
And we're doing that.
Okay, that's good. But it seems like putting together the TAC is a key piece of that.
Mike, I think Jeff made it very clear right at the end of the ag waiver, made that overture that any changes or ideas or improvements or whatever can be brought to the board.
It's easier said than done, but
well,
yes.
Well, I understand that, but and I realize that it's easy to say, but to get it to us a lot of times
right.
is very difficult. But I think that having established an attack, it could bounce a lot of these projects against them and refine them to get to us.
Yep.
And the door has to be open to these folks.
Let's get back on track.
Why?
Well, I'm being signaled by our other attorney. So
this is so important, so critical to our region. It's just
priorities.
I'm
looking at the summary of implementation in the EO report for Farman on page 7. It does point out what Michael was just saying about initiating outreach to stakeholders and individuals who have expressed interest in participating in the TAC, and goes on to discuss that just a little bit more. So we're a little further along than what I indicated.
Good. Bruce?
Can we spend some time before we adjourn on the advocacy and recommendation section D on page 6?
We're going to do that. Are you ready for that?
Well, actually, I was going to revise my revision and suggest holding off on that.
Did you have a revision on the advocacy and recommendation?
And breaking this part off, and we'll take that up later. But if you'd rather do that, now it's your choice.
Roger, do you have to be out by 5?
Yeah. Well, I think we have until 5:20 or something like that.
But well, it seemed like a political. We got letters back in 2011 and again 2012. And I'm sure there's still some controversy in the minds of elected officials such as Sam Farr about this issue. So it seems like it's an important issue to discuss sometime.
Yeah, that's why I put it in here. But I didn't know we're going to spend as much time as we did on the first part. So it's your choice.
Well, how much more? What do you want to cover the next hour?
Closed session.
Oh, closed session.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
To do that.
So my suggestion is to take this up.
And we actually need an hour for closed session?
Well, that's up to you. But based on past history, yes.
Based on our track record, maybe 2 hours.
Yeah.
Okay, anyway, my recommendation is to take up these other issues the next available opportunity, not waiting until the next offsite meeting.
Well, can we discuss this tomorrow at closed session? I mean, no. This would have to be an open
session.
Advocacy and recommendations, yeah.
We could probably do that.
Yeah.
Can we discuss it?
Hold it over. Okay.
Tomorrow. Let's try to pencil in somewhere. You tell us where it could fit in.
Good.
And you said there was a revision. I only got a revision for item 12.
I was making a revision on how we proceed right now.
Mr. Chair, the sooner we address that, the better off.
Okay. So we need to fit it in tomorrow.
Okay.
Into the agenda.
That sounds good.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, you're here to listen to that?
Okay.
Yeah. You can take items out of order, so you could put it anywhere you want.
Well, but there will be people here for item 12, the timber waiver.
Item 12 and 13.
12 and 13. So
now the EO reports the.
If we want to say 11 a.m. at the earliest. No guarantee, you know how that works.
We're saying the earliest, not the latest. Yeah, fair enough.
And maybe you could get Harvey's cell number, and I don't know how far you're traveling, but
yeah, it'll be fine. Thank
can
you.
We get a webcast together and she could just watch that? And then
yeah.
Where do we want to? Are we going to insert it?
I think it should go after 13.
After 13.
Right.
Okay.
But those are really the only two discussion items on there.
All right. Okay. Yes, Steve.
Just as your new liaison, early in the discussion, a couple of board members, or I think it was Mr. Jeffries, asked about how your priorities line up with state board,
right.
And so I won't give you just a flip response, but generally speaking, I see a lot of congruity. And then as a board member, these type of priorities are meaningful. I just want to give you immediate feedback, but also I can provide you a more detailed kind of a matrix type thing if you want a strategic plan linkage to the priorities you're discussing. Provide, because I thought that was a valid question. And
that's something Jean-Pierre Wolf raised.
Yeah. So, I think generically it does. There's congruity. And certainly as a regional board, having experienced the regional level, I really respect the regionalization priorities. So, this one I use.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Kurt, did you have something
to
say?
No,
I couldn't tell whether I don't know if you were waving or I saw a hand. Okay. All right, Bruce.
If we talk tomorrow about advocacy versus, are we also able to talk about other things we didn't get to today, such as performance measures?
Yes. Okay. All right. So this concludes our open session component of today's board meeting. We're now going to go into closed session.
Yeah.
It is Salinas Valley, and you have no idea what the process was on the ag.